of researchers from the UK and the Netherlands have recently demonstrated a fully automated technology to allow physical robots to repeatedly breed, evolving their artificial genetic code over time to better adapt to their environment. Stay with us for an article concerning this issue authored by Emma Hart, a professor in the School of Computing at Edinburgh Napier University and a member of the Autonomous Robot Evolution, Cradle to Grave project at the University of York titled, Robots May Soon Be Able to Reproduce. Will this change how we think about evolution? This article was published by The Guardian Daily. From the bottom of the oceans to the skies above us, natural evolution has filled our planet with a vast and diverse array of life forms, with approximately 80 million species adapted to their surroundings in a myriad of ways. Yet, 100 years after Karel Čapek coined the term robot, the functional abilities of many species will surpass the capabilities of current human engineering, which has yet to convincingly develop methods of producing robots that demonstrate human-level intelligence, move and operate seamlessly in challenging environments, and are capable of robust self-reproduction. But could robots ever reproduce? This undoubtedly forms a pillar of life as shared by all natural organisms. A team of researchers from the UK and the Netherlands have recently demonstrated a fully automated technology to allow physical robots to repeatedly breed, evolving their artificial genetic code over time to better adapt to their environment. Arguably, this amounts to artificial evolution. Child robots are created by mixing the digital DNA from two parent robots on a computer. The new design is first sent to a 3D printer that fabricates the body of the robot. Then a robotic arm attaches a brain loaded with controlled software inherited from the parents, along with any new components, such as sensors, wheels, or joints, selected by this evolutionary process. A digital replica of every new robot is also created in a computer simulation. This enables a novel type of evolution. New generations can be produced from a union of the most successful traits, from a virtual mother and a physical father, combining the benefits of fast but potentially unrealistic simulated evolution with the more accurate assessments of robots in a real physical environment. The new robots therefore inherit traits that represent the best of both types of evolution. While this technology can operate without a human in the loop, it also allows for collaboration with a human breeder. Just as humans have been selectively breeding crops since the dawn of farming, the robot breeder could influence selection of robots with particular traits. One might even imagine breeding farms producing robots adapted to specific conditions and user requirements. They might be bred for qualities such as battery life or carbon footprint, just as we breed plants for drought resistance or taste. Such farms should be subject to the same strict controls and ethical considerations as, say, breeding of genetically modified crops, for example, enabling an entire facility to be shut down at the touch of a button, or limiting supplies of raw materials. Furthermore, it is also important to consider the possibility that evolution might result in robots exhibiting malicious or harmful behaviors and put appropriate preventive measures in place. The idea of digital evolution, imitating biological evolution in software to successfully breed better and better solutions to a problem over time is not new. It can be traced back to 1960s when engineers in Germany programmed a computer to evolve the optimal design of a joint plate subject to turbulent airflow. Since then, evolutionary algorithms operating inside a computer have been used to design everything from tables to turbine blades by simply telling the evolutionary process what metric it should seek to optimize, for example, the power generated by the turbine blade. In 2006, NASA sent a satellite into space with a communication antenna designed by artificial evolution. We are now at the breakthrough moment. While scientists have always been confident that digital evolution could be effective as an optimization tool, its creativity in producing original and unusual designs that would not have been conceived by a human has been more surprising. The creativity of the biological evolution is clearly apparent in the natural world. In the Cuban rainforest, vines have evolved leaves shaped like satellite dishes that amplify the signals propagated by echolocating bats to direct them to its flowers, increasing pollination. In the freezing Southern Ocean, fish manufacture their own antifreeze proteins to survive. Numerous examples of creativity in digital evolution have also been observed. Asked to find behaviors for six-legged robot that would enable it to walk even if it had been damaged, digital evolution discovered multiple ways of walking that used only subsets of the legs, even discovering a way for the robot to move if all its legs had been snapped up by shuffling along and back. In another case, it evolved on electronic circuits on a chip where elements of the circuit were disconnected, exploiting electromagnetic coupling effects specific to flaws in the silicon on the actual chip. Digital evolution now finds application in avenues that we might imagine to be uniquely human. For example, in creating music and art, even winning an award in a University of Wyoming art competition where judges were unaware the winning picture was created by an algorithm. While this may sound to the uninitiated like artificial intelligence, digital evolution is a specific subset of that wider field. The idea of harnessing evolution to design robots is particularly appealing, especially in cases where humans have little knowledge of the environments the robot should operate in. For example, undersea mining, cleanup of legacy waste inside a nuclear reactor, or using nanorobots to deliver drugs inside the human body. Unlike natural evolution, which is driven simply by the goals of survival and reproduction, artificial evolution can be driven by specific targets. Once this evolutionary process is set in chain and with the technology outlined above of a computer system instructing a 3D printer to create improved models of the robots for these particular environments, we have the beginnings of a theoretical framework for a self-sustaining robot population that is able to reproduce itself and evolve without too much input from humans. Digital evolution will probably be a collaborative process between human and machine, with humans providing descriptions of what is desired while evolution provides the how. So, for example, a human might demand an energy-efficient robot made from sustainable materials to move heavy waste inside a reactor, leaving evolution to figure out how this can be achieved. Advances in manufacturing technology that facilitate automated and rapid prototyping in a range of materials, including flexible soft plastics, have important role in enhancing our ability to replicate evolution on practical timescales. If this all might seem to border on science fiction, there is a serious point. Robots clearly have a role to play in our future, whether in revolutionizing healthcare or undertaking tasks too dangerous for humans. We are rapidly using up stores of raw materials on our planet, and current manufacturing processes increase carbon emissions and create serious problems with waste disposal. Perhaps the creativity of evolutionary methods will enable the design of new types of robots unfettered by the constraints that our understanding of engineering, physics, and material science impose on current design processes. Emma Hart, the author of this article, concluded, from another perspective, until we discover extraterrestrial life, biologists have only one system on which to study evolution. Just as Large Hadron Collider provides us with an instrument to study the intricacies of particle physics, perhaps a reproducing system of robots provides a new instrument to study fundamental questions about life itself.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Ghaira in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Ghaira, sometimes transliterated as ghaira, is an Arabic word which means a person's dislike of another's sharing in a right which belongs to the former. It has a sense of earnest concern or zeal over something and can be considered a kind of protective jealousy. If you want to understand what ghaira is, there's no translation, so to speak, in English language. It is an Arabic word. You can, probably call it a protective jealousy. So it's a positive thing, right? In Islam, there are different kinds of ghaira. That which relates to Allah and which relates to a Muslim. Allah's discontent is with sharing and obedience of His servant, which rightfully belongs to Him. So if Allah's servant is being disobedient to the enemies of Allah, this is where you can say that protective jealousy comes into the picture, right? This is not something appropriate for a believer to do. You cannot be subservient to Allah, His Prophet, His Ahlul Bayt, and Islam, and the teachings of Islam, and at the same time be subservient to the enemies of Islam, to the enemies of Ahlul Bayt, to the enemies of Prophet, to the enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The two don't reconcile. For a Muslim, it is the uneasiness in his heart which moves him to guard his family from indecency. If you go and inspect Surah An-Nisa of Quran, verse number 34, you see the instances of that. If you go to Surah At-Tahrim of Quran and look at the verse number 6, you will see instances of that, which we don't have time to cover here. But do go pick up the Quran and look at these two verses to understand ghaira, the concept of ghaira in Islam. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about ghaira, or sometimes pronounced as ghaira in Islam. It's an Arabic term which we said can be loosely translated to protective jealousy. Now, the foundation of the religion is this ghaira. And the one without ghaira is one without religion. For ghaira protects the heart and enlivens the limbs, and shields one from evil and lewdness, and lack of ghira kills the heart so that the limbs die, so that there remains not even shielding from the minor things. And this is where you see people who do not have ghira, they commit sins so easily, right? Who lack ghira. And the example of ghira in the heart is the example of the strength that shields one from sickness and fights it off. So if the strength leaves, he will be faced with the sickness and will not find anything to protect himself from it. So it will establish itself within him and destroy him, right? See how important this ghira is in our decision making. Sometimes, you know, people make decisions that make you wonder and you become surprised at what happened to this person's ghira. How in the world can he allow his wife, his daughter, you know, his other family members, his cousins to act in this lewd manner, right? Sometimes we wonder, some of our friends, maybe some of our acquaintances, maybe making those wrong decisions. But how do we, interpret those decisions? It is through the concept of ghira, the concept of protective jealousy, right? And this is something which is a gift of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the believers. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Back in June 2019, Iran shot down an intruding RQ-4A Global Hawk unmanned reconnaissance aircraft with surface-to-air missiles over the coastal province of Hormozgan. The high-tech spy drone belonged to the United States and had a price tag of over $120 million. Americans claimed that the drone was flying in international airspace when hit. However, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif dismissed the claim and later in the day announced that Iran had located parts of the drone in its territorial waters. The downing of the American spy drone sent a strong message to Washington. It signaled that Iran's deterrence power is way higher than Americans' expectation and that Iran will not be bullied by any country, even the U.S. Any intrusion on its soil and airspace will be met harshly. They are its red lines. The incident was not the first time a U.S. military spy drone was seized or shot down by Iran's air defense forces. There were several similar instances in the previous years. Washington, which found its image damaged by the incident, threatened Tehran with a military attack. However, knowing Iran's defensive capabilities, the U.S. refrained from an armed confrontation. Coincidentally, Iran experienced cyber attacks after that. The U.S. also imposed fresh anti-Iran sanctions against Tehran's move. Iran has always said that its military power is solely for defensive purposes and does not pose any threat to other countries. Nevertheless, Iran says it will not leave any act of aggression against its territory unanswered.
Well, my take on this was that the Americans were trying to provoke the Iranians into an intemperate, overly aggressive response. The Americans are trying to push the Iranians into a corner and force them to retaliate against an American provocation that would guarantee the United States would be able to say, see, look what the Iranians have done to us. We have to go in with horse foot and guns and teach them a lesson and end their aggressive ways. So I think that by making a temperate response, knocking down the drone, and then sitting back and waiting for the American reaction was an excellent example of a very cool, calculated response by the Iranian government. They would not be bullied, and they would not let themselves be pushed into a corner and making a mistake.
On January 3rd last year, top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. 5 days later, Iran retaliated by firing dozens of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base in Al Anbar Governorate, western Iraq, declaring that the attacks were part of its promised tough revenge for the assassination. It also sent a message to Israel not to continue threatening Iran militarily. According to Pentagon, over 100 American soldiers suffered traumatic brain injuries as a result of the missile strike against Ain al-Assad. Since then, U.S. bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Also, Washington has started to withdraw its anti-missile batteries from countries including Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. The move reflects recent changes on the ground in the West Asia region.
But as I was told, the Americans simply think that they can get away with it. So the Iranian response in Iraq after the murder of Lieutenant General Soleimani and the deputy director of the Popular Mobilization Units in Iraq was, again, a very temperate response. The Iranians told the Americans through the Iraqis that a response is coming, that rockets will be fired, and you better run for the hills. So I think that the Iranians have again proved that they will not be bullied, they will not be provoked, and it's the Americans who are the danger, the Americans who are constantly seeking an attempt to start a war against Iran.
The presence of U.S. forces in the West Asia region has increased instability. This is most notably seen in Iraq, then in Syria and Afghanistan. Yemen could be on that list too. After spending trillions of dollars in West Asia, the U.S. has nothing to show for it, something the former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted to. Iran's Judiciary Chief Seyed Ebrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide. He managed to secure nearly 18 million of the votes and become the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Some 29 million Iranians voted in Iran's 13th presidential election. Raisi won the presidential race amid an all-out political and media war led by the United States and its Western and regional allies targeting the event. The Islamic Republic's opponents attempted to portray a gloomy picture of the polls to discourage popular contribution. However, the Iranian people foiled the enemy's plots as the turnout was beyond their perceived low notion. Also, the public reception forced officials to extend the time limit on the election, with polls remaining open until past midnight. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, praised the epic turnout in Iran's 13th presidential election. The leader said the high turnout neutralized the campaigns launched by the enemy's media outlets and ill-wishers to create voter apathy in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei said nothing could break the Iranian nation's will and disrupt the election. Meanwhile, the outgoing Iranian President Hassan Rouhani met President-elect Ebrahim Raisi in person to congratulate. The outgoing president stated his full support for his successor and stressed his willingness to offer assistance to the new government. In turn, President-elect Raisi pledged all-out efforts to resolve the country's problems, especially those affecting the people's livelihoods. Raisi noted that he would consult with the outgoing administration, parliament, and the elites to achieve the goal. Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi received congratulatory messages from several world leaders for winning Friday's presidential election, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, who expressed hope for further development of constructive cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Raisi will take office in 45 days. He has promised to form a hard-working, anti-corruption, and revolutionary cabinet and fight corruption and uproot poverty.
You know, we can say that the main and the only loser in this election was were those who actually were discouraging people from going to the ballot boxes and turn out to vote. And either if those politicians inside Iran or those dissident Iranians outside Iran, in some cases, who attacked actually the voters against the law. So they were the main losers because they were trying to discourage people to turn out, to say that people are not supporting the government, and that means that there is lack of legitimacy, and because of that, the government should not be respected and considered respected, actually, being recognized in, by other countries.
Sixty-year-old Ebrahim Raisi will take office in August. He is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Raisi has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. He campaigned with the slogan, Popular Administration, Strong Iran, on a platform of uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty and inflation, and creating jobs. President-elect Raisi is set to take power at a critical time as Iran seeks to salvage its tattered nuclear deal with major powers and free itself from illegal and inhumane U.S. sanctions that have driven a sharp economic downturn. Washington has been using sanctions as a weapon by preventing Iran from buying even its necessities and blocking the country's access to its overseas financial resources. Ebrahim Raisi had stated before that he would vigorously pursue efforts to get rid of sanctions imposed by the United States. He had said that his government would not allow the economy to be conditioned by the fate of sanctions removal talks, adding that Iranians want the economy to be stable.
You know, first, either the Americans lift the sanctions or not, Iran is going to diversify its basket of the diplomacy and the foreign policy and relations with other countries.
So Iran has signed a memorandum of understanding for 25 years with China, is working on something similar to that with Russia and with some other countries. And it means that Iran is going to move forward and move on from the JCPOA and do not rely only on that. It's not the basket to put all the eggs on that.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi has vowed to pursue sanctions removal efforts. He has noted that one should not deal abjectly with those who want to trample over the rights of the Iranian people. With him being the president, Washington is faced with a choice: remove all sanctions and return to compliance if it truly wants to save the nuclear deal, or follow the path of its past, confrontation and threats. Meanwhile, Iran has forged strong ties with both Russia and China and will proceed with its agenda with or without the U.S.
Relations between the United States and Russia came under the spotlight this week as presidents of the two geopolitical rivals sat down for talks in Geneva. Before the meeting, Washington and Moscow had acknowledged that relations were at rock bottom. A series of tit-for-tat actions, which escalated in recent years, has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Moscow and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. The depth of differences between the two sides had dashed hopes of any breakthrough during the meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The Geneva talks lasted around 3 hours. The two presidents did not even come close to resolving any of the acrimonious conflicts that have sent U.S.-Russian ties to their lowest level in decades. However, Biden and Putin agreed to launch a dialogue on atomic arms control. They also said that they would return ambassadors to Washington and Moscow to ease diplomatic contacts. The ambassadors were withdrawn in March for consultations after Washington accused Moscow of interference in America's 2020 presidential election. That is a claim that Moscow vehemently denies. The agreements in Geneva this week have somehow reduced bilateral tensions for now, but it is definitely too early to know whether the two rivals will eventually engage in meaningful cooperation. The presidents of the U.S. and Russia hailed their dialogue in Geneva. The Russian president said Biden was an experienced statesman. But despite the pleasantries, deep differences persisted in the meeting and after that. There was almost no sign of agreement on issues like cybersecurity and Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Putin warned the U.S. against imposing new sanctions on Russia. Putin and Biden also clashed over human rights issues with the American leader, threatening devastating consequences for Moscow if Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who is now serving a 2.5-year sentence, died in jail.
As we know, Washington loves to throw human rights violation allegations against everyone, which is now extremely ironic because the current official president of the United States and many Democrats around him acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has legitimate gripes with the United States. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that claims that the United States grossly violates the human rights of its own citizens.
Putin dismissed U.S. concerns about Navalny, telling Biden that the opposition leader had ignored the law. The Russian president also criticized the status of human rights in America. Putin specifically named the Black Lives Matter movement and the January 6th attack on Capitol as two cases that show the U.S. has its own grave human rights-related problems. Observers believe it is too soon to judge the outcome of the Geneva meeting. Can the two rivals somehow build on their recent meeting, bridge their differences, and hammer out compromises in the future?
If you look back to the 1990s, after the triumph in the Cold War, the United States sat down, well, certain important elites sat down and wrote the Project for a New American Century. And one of the absolute and most key points of that project, to make the century completely American, is to not allow a new competitor to rise. And when you have this sort of zero-sum game, 0-1, you know, win or lose sort of scenario, there's really no way to find any sort of true compromise or make any sort of friendly deal of any sort of meaning.
Bilateral talks on strategic arms limitations could start in a matter of weeks. The talks could serve as a test of the two sides' political will to engage in meaningful diplomacy and cooperation.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt that some of this is going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also a strong vested interest getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
The Light.
The J German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot, just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter. It will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city with our shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5 kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Paide. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally. Palestinian artist has come up with the idea of making children feel happy after the recent Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip left many people dead. Amna Sami is a young Palestinian artist who has gathered Palestinian kids in the city of Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. That's where houses were destroyed by Israeli airstrikes and bombings during the recent aggression on the territory. Sami draws the Palestinian flag as well as the map of Palestine on children's cheeks as patriotic symbols. She says she does that to say that these people in the midst of destruction will become strong again. Sami says by painting on kids' faces, she wants to send a message to the world.
I'm sending a message to the world that our children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched this devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war. A Turkish band has found musical inspiration in a most unlikely place, a local landfill. Here's more. Members of Funk Istanbul have assembled instruments from the dump in a junkyard in Istanbul. They use their ingenious new tools to play Turkish folk music. The band aims to raise awareness about recycling. Turkey is one of the biggest producers of municipal waste globally. The country has a low recycling rate. Only 12% of waste is repurposed there.
Technology has come in handy to rescue animals in disaster zones. American cinematographer Douglas Thrun has used a high-tech infrared drone to save animals from fire or storm, or even those who are stuck in trees. The drone he uses has a large thermal camera, a spotlight, and zoom lens. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise, therefore it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife, and then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thrun has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the U.S. and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal. A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pimp. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath. Might be pleased to know life is going back to normal as countries around the world are easing coronavirus restrictions. Disneyland in the French capital of Paris is saying bonjour to visitors once again with all necessary precautions. Bet everyone missed that. The theme park reopened its doors to the public with limited tickets and an online reservation system. All visitors over 6 years old are required to wear face masks and to observe social distancing guidelines. New attractions, including a hotel and various car rides, are also available for guests. Disneyland Paris was shut for over 7 months due to rising COVID-19 infections. This is the first time since January 2020 that all the six Disney resorts are open. Children have their own ways of remembering the dead. In Gaza, Palestinian kids fly kites in memory of their peers who lost their lives in the recent Israeli onslaught. Dozens of kids participated in the event, holding kites bearing the pictures of 66 little victims. According to the organizers, the goal was to send a message to people around the world that Palestinian kids have the right to live a free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd
herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only 5. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she's inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years.
Go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Kayuba, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo.
Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonius has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun art and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste. And how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz. Every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in